Good morning, everyone. I'm Mark Harrower. I'm a cartographer and designer at Esri, and this is Jim Harries. And Jim and I have been working on smart mapping and a bunch of other mapping initiatives. We want to walk you through that today. Jim and I have given this talk a couple of times. We've been talking about it for at least 2 years here at the UC, and so we don't want to just retread the same material over and over again. We don't want to just, you know, especially if some of you have already heard our sales pitch on this. So what we want to do is make sure we have time to get feedback from you, ask a lot of questions. We want to make sure that the direction that we've been going with smart mapping with each release in ArcGIS Online and now with Pro is something that's resonating with you, is something that's useful. And so please give us lots of feedback. And so we're going to keep this actually a little less structured. It's not just going to be 700 PowerPoint slides, and you just have to sit there for 75 minutes and just listen to us drone on. We really do want to make this much more interactive. The other thing we're going to do is, because this is real live technology, this isn't demoware, it's been live for 2 years, we're going to actually bring up some maps and walk through it and show you some of the techniques that Jim employs for some of the amazing maps that he and his team have been creating during this time. The other thing is, everything that we're showing you today is live, and you can go and try it yourself. You can start with these finished maps, you can reverse engineer them if you want, you can get the data, you can play with it yourself and try it for yourself. So don't think of this as, oh, well, you have to be a Jim Harries and you need 3 months and you need to, you know, have a PhD in cartography. What we're hoping to impress upon you is that you can do this work yourself in less than 10 clicks of a mouse. And so that's why we're really passionate about this. How many people here have never heard the term smart mapping until this week? A couple of you. Okay. Cool. How many of you have heard the sort of smart mapping sales pitch before and have a sense of what it is? Okay, a few of you. How many of you use ArcGIS Online at some point in your workflow? Okay, great. That means all of you have touched smart mapping, those of you who use ArcGIS Online. Rather cynically, we might say smart mapping is largely a marketing effort, but I hope you'll appreciate it's actually much more than that. It's what we're trying to do is make the experience of authoring maps, sharing those maps, and using those maps just a whole lot better, and to bring in some ideas from data exploration. So why don't we jump into it, Jim? I'm going to sort of set the context. We're going to talk about our ongoing work. We're going to show some of what's been happening in the last few releases. The great thing about ArcGIS Online, it's a web application. What does that mean? It means we can have 3 releases a year at least. And so we do. And every time we release new capabilities along with smart mapping. And we want to show you how we use the capabilities to solve problems that we have as cartographers. And so Jim and I struggle with the same things you do. We have data. We want to tell a story. We want to explore that data. We want to know what's the really interesting thing inside this data set that we should be communicating. We have the same challenges. I think you just turned us off.
Oh. I hit the button.
You did. Awesome. So that's really what we want to do. And that's why we want to switch over really in the second half to just live demos and just have you sort of yell things out at us. There you go. Next slide. Theme for all of this, the democratization of data visualization. Data visualization is a robust field. It's been around for around 25 years, probably longer depending on your definition. But it's always been assumed that it was in the domain of experts. You needed to have a PhD in something. You needed to be a data wizard. The public wouldn't have been interested in this. And really what we've seen is a reversal against that notion of sort of the elitism of data visualization and saying, you know, lots of people have questions. And a good example of where you're seeing data visualization influencing public discourse, how many of you have ever used interactive maps from The Guardian, Washington Post, or The New York Times? How many of you have used, you know, like they have like little sliders and you zoom in and out? I'm seeing a couple of people saying no. If you haven't, check them out. They're some of the best work in the world. Guardian, New York Times, Washington Post. Amazing work. They're bringing ideas from data visualization to a huge audience of people who are like, oh, what? I can do dynamic data classification, or I can use sliders and change the visualization, or I can extrude things into 3 dimensions. These basic techniques are now no longer locked up in an expensive desktop experience, but are being brought to the masses through a browser. And so that's been the challenge for us. Smart mapping, what is it? Just briefly, for those of you who are new to it, enable people to make brilliant maps quickly and with confidence. The with confidence thing is a really big part of this. How many times, I know I've experienced this, how many times have you think back over the years where you've used software that you may use infrequently? And a good example for me was, for years I used SPSS to do statistical work. I was never quite good enough to know if I was clicking exactly the right buttons. I always got an answer, but I was never very confident in my answer. I'm like, well, it didn't crash, so I guess that's good. And I got something called an R-squared, so I guess that's what the number I'm going to report. But I had low confidence. And we see this a lot in cartography. People are like, I don't have a background in color theory. I'm not a graphic designer. I don't know how to do really subtle, you know, effects in cartography. I got a map. I loaded my data into the GIS, and I got a map on the screen. I guess the five-class choropleth map is the right way to represent my data. We see this again and again and again. So people don't know what their cartographic options are. They don't know how to experiment with what's capable in the system to tell different types of stories. So we want to up the confidence that people can explore and know they're getting the right answer. We want to simplify the authoring experience. Who here likes to click 50 times when you could have clicked 3 times? Have you guys ever had that experience where someone shows you a shortcut and you're like, seriously, I didn't know about this for years. This would have saved me. Yeah, we all love that. Next, data-driven workflows. If you remember one thing about smart mapping, remember this. It's a really, really powerful idea, and that is that the authoring experience ought to be a conversation with your data. It needs to reflect and represent the nature of your data. Let me give you an example. If you're working with categorical information, counts of things, you know, how many fast food restaurants are there, or, you know, just categories of things, there are some numerical operators that make no sense, right? You're not going to do a standard deviation of categories. It just doesn't make sense. Why would you offer that in a pull-down menu as if it were a legitimate way to analyze the data? And so what we're saying is we need to look at the data, and we've been doing this for the last 2 years, and Pro's doing it now, quickly at the author time, and say, oh, you're dealing with points that have numeric information attached to them, and there's 1,000 of them, and they're distributed this way, and we can make a whole bunch of inferences about the geometry, about the data, about the type of data that it is, and offer you sensible choices. And when I mean sensible, the sort of thing that if you sat down with a professional, they'd say, oh yeah, this is probably the way you should represent this data set, right? And when you, and so the phrase that really kicked this off was, how do we get a cartographer and that expertise into the DNA of the software, so that even if you don't have a background in this, even if you've not done a lot of mapping and thematic mapping in particular, you have confidence that the choices in front of you are the right ones. How many times have you used software, and our software is guilty of this as anyone else, where you're at a point and you're not sure what to do next, and you look at all the pull-down menus and you look at all this ribbons and ribbons and ribbons of buttons, and there are 500 options, only about 3 of which are actually appropriate for the moment where you are in your workflow, but you don't know what those 3 are, and you have to hunt for them. And you're like, is it in the filter menu? No. Is it in the group? No, it's not there. And you just sort of like hunt through, and you're like, why am I being given so many choices? I don't know which ones to use. What we want to do is simplify the authoring experience so that no matter where you click, you will succeed. Every option is legally defendable. No cartographer would be, oh, why did you do that? That was stupid. You should never have done that to your data. If we can get to that, that's kind of the benchmark for us. And we want to bake the expertise into the tools. A lot of people are already very good at doing something else. They're economists, they're geologists, they're political scientists. We can't say to them, go and read this 400-page textbook in cartography so that your maps aren't terrible. Like, that's just not, like, that's not a good answer. We've got to do better than that. How much of the map making process can we automate? A surprising amount. And we'll show you examples of what we mean by that. Here's some that I want to highlight. How many of you have ever set visible range on a map? How far the user can zoom in and how far they can zoom out? Show of hands, how many of you have done that? Okay, great. How do you do that? How do you decide that, like, the map should stop at zoom level 4? Does anyone have a systematic way for doing this? All of you did, you're all, your shoulders went up, and you just kind of eyeball it, right? And so it's true. It's a very qualitative thing. What we challenged ourselves to do, and this was one of the first things we did with smart mapping, was look at the nature of the data, the geometry, the size, the average size of things like polygons, their distribution, the range and sizes, and figure out numerically with an algorithm what we think are the optimal visible range. The old way to do this was to let the map by default zoom all the way from building footprint out to globe. Let me give you an example of why that's a really bad idea. If all of your data are concentrated in a small place, like let's say you're looking for where to locate the next store in San Diego, what good does it do your readers to let them zoom out to see New Zealand? The data has nothing to do with New Zealand. All you're doing is building more UI, consuming more bandwidth, and inviting them to get lost. Have you guys ever gotten lost in a map where you've panned and zoomed so badly you don't know where you are anymore, and you just get frustrated, you either like reload the browser because you just don't know where you are? That's a failed experience. We should build gentle limits around the capabilities of our map so people never end up with them in that place. We figured that out, and it's been really cool work. I don't have time to get into it, but there's some very cool things that we've been able to automate behind this. New types of maps, and this is where Jim's really going to shine today, not to put any pressure on him. New types of maps allow you to tell new types of stories. If the only tool you have is a hammer and a screwdriver, it limits what you can build, right? And if the only maps you have are proportional symbol and choropleth, and they're univariate, and they're classed, guess what? All of your stories are going to kind of look the same. if you suddenly say, wait, I can do different types of renders, I can do bivariate, I can do multivariate, I can do unclassed, I can do filtering, I can use transparency in really creative ways, and you'll see all of that today. Suddenly you have new ways to communicate, new ways to explore, new insights. And Jim will walk us through some examples of where literally by changing the render, the data stay the same, you change the renderer type, and suddenly like, wait, I'm seeing something completely new in my data. I had never seen that before. Better yet, if it's one click away, chances of you trying it out are pretty high. If you have to hunt through submenus and gear icons and little checkboxes that are behind other windows, you're never going to get there. Right? That's a philosophy that we have here. So let's move on to the next. This is, for those of you who haven't seen it yet, this is an ArcGIS online window, UI, and what we were really keen on, a couple key things. Visuals. People don't know what to ask for. They don't know they need a bivariate choropleth map with diverging color schemes. A lot of people don't know how to ask for that. But if you show them like a picture in a menu and you say, is this the story you want to tell? And it's one click away, they can try it out. It instantly previews. It instantly uses good defaults. One of the things that we've been challenging ourselves is every single parameter of the map has to be set. The color ramps, the opacity amounts, the line weights, the borders of the like polygons, all of these things have to be set. There are at least 50 parameters in any map that have to be set by default in order for it to render immediately. What we've been doing is systematically going through those and trying to improve the default so that what you see instantly looks really good. And a map like this is one or two clicks away. 3 years ago, this would have been a whole day's worth of work, right? And so this idea that you can empower people to do really advanced things with confidence. The other thing is that the choices you see down that menu change based on your data, and based on whether you bring in a second variable or a third variable, you get different gallery choices. So you don't even need to know to ask for it. We'll offer it to you, and if you are so inclined, you can click on it and try it out. And we'll show you some live examples of this in just a second. I just want to, or, dumb defaults have to die. A dumb default, and we see this in every piece of software we use. And I mean, Adobe does this, Microsoft does this, Apple does this, we all do this. A dumb default is the same every single time. No matter what I load, no matter what I'm working on, no matter where I am in my workflow, it always says, hey, guess what? You're going to get a 2-pixel black border on all of your polygons. Why? Well, because some developer just wrote that at some point and that was the default. A way better system says, hey, you seem to have a lot of polygons. You're mapping 3,000 US counties. It's just not going to look good with a 2-pixel black border around each one of those 3,000 US counties. We've all seen maps like that, right? They're just like they're a mess. What if the map were smart enough to say, wait, I need to thin that and use a 1-pixel at 50% transparency in a middle gray so that you can still see the fill color in those polygons without it being overwhelmed by this massive black? We all do that, but I'm frustrated when every single time, and Jim, we talk about this, every single time there's like 10 things I have to undo from the defaults to get it to what I want. Wouldn't it be cool if we just started you there? Multivariate mapping. Let's talk about, this was part of the November release, yeah. I think. Yeah, and this was I was so excited to see this. Why is multivariate mapping so powerful? Why do professional cartographers love it, have been using it for 150 years? What does it allow us to do that merely saying, I have one layer of data set like income and one layer of data set of education? What does a multivariate map offer that goes beyond merely adding new layers to a map? Go back one screen just so we can see that's a multivariate map there. Size tells us one thing, color tells us something else. Why is this better than merely having like two choropleth maps sitting on top of each other? You can see the relationship. That's exactly right. And you can also say more, and it's also less cluttered. If I had a choropleth map of income and then one of, say, education, I'd have to make one like 50% transparent so that I could see the colors underneath it, and then it's just this weird collage of colors that don't actually match anything in the legend, and you don't know how to interpret the data. So what you need is to be able to explore relationships in a way that isn't cluttered. So this is why multivariate mapping we think is pretty awesome. So I'll turn it over to Jim, and he can walk us through some examples of these.
Yeah, I've got a couple I'd love to show you. Here's one of the first ones. We hunted this map for a year. A coworker, Sam Berg, asked. He was working on a project in Albany, New York, related to single parents with kids and where to locate like a Head Start type program or other resources for single parents. And at the time, we couldn't make this map. We're happy now that within one or two clicks, let me show you how to make this map. I'm going to copy it. I'm going to turn off the final version, kind of like those cooking shows where, you know, they spend 10 minutes doing the work and then all of a sudden, let me just pull out the finished product out of the oven. So here's the raw ingredients. I have this data set. Hey, how did the map just change? It went from a dot map, a bubble map, to polygons. Well, it's the source data is a polygonal data set. And as soon as I tell it, I'm interested in those homes where there are two parents. Where I'm interested in the a rate field to start. So show me a map. This is the rate or the percentage of households where there's a female head of household. And it ranges from, if I touch the options, it'll tell me it ranges from 0 to 77%. And in this data set, the average census tract in the area has 28% female head of households. One standard deviation above the mean is 45%. One standard deviation below that mean is 13. So what smart mapping does is it aligns the color with whatever pattern is available in this data set so that you have confidence a dark purple color is statistically interesting. It's significant, right? Because every map we make, you know, the audience may know the topic or they may not know the topic. How many of you walked in here knowing that 27% of tracts, 28% of households in New York are single parent, single female parent? None of us knew. But now we know that because the histogram talks to us and the color talks to us and says, okay, see this corridor? There's a nice long corridor of significantly greater concentrations. Now, if we add an attribute and actually work with not just the rate, but the count of female head of household with children under 18, now we have both. And we still have that purple corridor, but we have a count. And why is the count important? Well, if you're going to open a Head Start program, you need to populate it. You need to know, I'm going to locate in the neighborhood where it's relatively easy for the most people to get. And so suddenly this map, instead of kind of guessing where I should locate in Albany, it's kind of pretty clear if I'm somewhere in this corridor, I'm going to be sandwiched between two high concentrations. And that's one of the reasons we like bivariate maps.
This is a much more realistic portrayal of where people are than the polygon-based map. Polygon-based map assumes that square miles are the most important thing. It's actually people that matter. We've got some more examples that we'll get to.
Good pattern. You got a rate and a count, but they're both on the same subject, right? Another
question?
Yeah, absolutely. We want questions whenever you want to shout them out.
The legend, does it say anywhere how it determined what the legend was? I mean, I know you showed it, but like for the final product?
Yeah, the legend is shown right here. It's a great question. What I often recommend people do is step one, explore the data a little bit, get familiar, and then start to compare what the data is showing against either known policies or if you've done a little literature review and there's a tipping point once a neighborhood achieves, you know. Go introduce the real world back into the data and the map. And that's where smart mapping actually becomes smart. This is not a presentation. Smart mapping is not about the software telling you what to do. We're just here to help. Software is just here to help. The smart part comes from people doing due diligence and asking a question, well, how can I help? You know, at what rate would we want to affect change in this neighborhood? Or maybe there's going to be, oftentimes there are government programs or even private programs where they need a certain threshold to be met in order to take action. And you can anchor your map around that threshold. If you're in a meeting, you've made this map, but they say, you know, I'm really interested in funding anything over 35%. You just change the map real quick and the map is updated. You continue with your conversation. So it's not that smart mapping dictates it, but it does allow you to kind of inject your knowledge into the map as simply as dragging a slider bar or typing in a value. It's a great way to anchor your map against reality. I'll give one other quick example of bivariate. This is median age in Phoenix, Arizona. Anyone from Phoenix? There you go. So this might be an interesting map. The first time we drew this, we're like, okay, this is kind of cool. We looked at the data set, and we're showing median age as one variable, and the growth rate in population, the predicted growth rate over the next 5 years is shown. And if I kind of touch in this, so I've got the color is being controlled here by median age. The median in Phoenix is 37.4, which I'm going to round out to 37, because who walks around at a party, hey, how old are you? I'm 44.2. Like, thank you, walking away. So I'm going to round that out, make it nice and even. And then I've got one standard deviation above and below the mean. I want you to watch what happens here. Why did we do this? Well, we could do other techniques, but the reason we use standard deviations and like them so much, I'm going to make this what I call, or others call, outlier-driven cartography, where the only way you get that bright orange color is if you're at the min value of the data set. And the only way you get this bright color in the color ramp is if you're at the max value of the data set. Notice what happened to the map. Most of the detail went away. There's only this part of the map is now interesting. And maybe that's the story you're after. That's okay. We found that what most people do is they kind of want to know, looking at the histogram, you know, when we're trying to explain a subject to somebody, well, what's normal? Oftentimes we use averages or medians to express a degree of normalcy, right? What's the normal median age? If you just walk up to somebody on the street in Arizona, chances are good they're going to be around 37 years of age. And then by using one standard deviation above and below the mean, we feel we give you, that's the part of confidence building, that you know that just by choosing this, when you walk in the door and make this map, by using that standard deviation, you're going to be reasonably sure that you've got an interesting above, below, and normal pattern, and you can apply these themes where maybe you want to just kind of smear a set of colors across the values from young and dark to bright. So here, this map is kind of emphasizing the bright, older people. As a 49-year-old, I appreciate that. The above and below pattern is where we started. So I can see the younger communities are in green and the older communities are in purple. Maybe you want to focus on the middle of the histogram, all the neighborhoods where people are right around that median. Or maybe you're interested in the extremes. With one click, you just try out these different points of view.
And you can adjust these handles. They're just being intelligent. We try to be intelligent about how we set them initially, but the idea is that, like, if you can click and drag, you can explore your data. One of the things that I find is sometimes there are subtle patterns that emerge by almost manually animating. So if you can grab, like, the middle handle there, move it up just a nudge or back, and you'll suddenly see, like, what error. You see how much change is happening there. This just underscores how difficult traditional classification is in cartography. Where do you draw the break between the red and the orange on your map? And where you draw that line has a huge impact on what you're seeing. So I like the fact that this doesn't lock you in and says, look, fine, explore. If you're not entirely convinced where the line should be, adjust it yourself.
Try disconnecting. I think it's you, Jim. Okay, good.
It's my magnetic personality. Right,
so
well, that's a pretty good one.
Yeah, and so we really like that because it moves beyond one of the traditional problems in cartography, which is that it puts things into these absolute buckets. You know, there's five buckets that every observation has to fall into, and they're so rigid, and the world is much more subtle than that.
So those are cool ones. We probably want to keep progressing through our
segments. We've got more. We can come back to these if we want. So I'll just quickly walk through these. This is a good example where you would map something because you're not quite sure if there is a relationship. Often early in the knowledge discovery analysis process, you have a hunch. It's not yet a formal hypothesis, but you think there might be a relationship between A and B. With this new multivariate mapping, because it takes two clicks, as Jim was showing you, to juxtapose two data sets, you can say, hey, is there a relationship between areas of predicted high growth here in Boston and areas of unemployment? And it looks like actually there kind of is. The world isn't quite random. There are large sort of geographic patterns that play out across the surface of the Earth. And so we're seeing the question you would ask is, do the large circles predominantly have one color? So those are areas that have high growth or high unemployment, but potentially high growth. Mm-hmm. And so as a city planner, now there may or may not be a relationship there, but this is a quick way to do it. How many of you, the first time someone gives you a data, the first thing you want to do is open it and look at it, right? Just to sort of, like, you're not even going to do anything with it yet. You just want to make sure it's kind of all there, and you want to sort of experiment with it, play with it, and say, oh, yeah, okay, this is good. There's some good stuff in there. Any tool that lets you do that in a couple seconds can be integrated into your regular workflow really easily. And so we have a lot of people who do use smart mapping, not because they ever turn it into anything public, but because it's a really good way to sort of vet and clean up data and say, wait, there's got, they'll have one giant circle and they'll know that's got to be an outlier. There's something wrong with that. It's got to be a bad data value.
I have a lot of people use smart mapping online to just come to understand the data, and then they go talk to the developer and make sure that they create symbology in some custom app uses the values they discovered by using the smart mapping.
And so another example is here. Yeah. Roads are really hard to visualize cartographically. There are a lot of them, and they tend to get in each other's way. So we love being able to scale the thickness of the line based on volume of traffic. Now, what's interesting here is you start to see this sort of almost like blood circulation-like system emerge. This is a piece of Central Florida. But they were color-coded, taking it one step further, by jurisdiction. And so what you can see is perhaps jurisdictions need to coordinate because the jurisdiction boundaries aren't necessarily the natural way to think about these arteries. And so you have sort of two different processes. And we don't know if this is true. Maybe these folks are actually coordinating in an interesting way. But you see that usage doesn't follow jurisdiction lines. This map goes further. Same idea. The thickness of the line is the traffic volume. The color is the risk. High degree of risk, low degree of risk. In other words, how dangerous is this section of road? Why did it make so much sense for the cartographer here to add the terrain, the hill shading, underneath these roads? This is Salt Lake City. This is mountainous. There's some mountains here that go up to 13,000 feet.
Makes sense.
Why does it make sense? Exactly. Terrain is an important part of this story. If all you're mapping is volume and risk, you're mapping the outcome, but you're not mapping the predict, like what are the influencing factors? And one of the things that influences, if you've lived in the mountains in the winter, snow, ice, freezing temperatures, twisty curves, it's dangerous to drive in mountain roads. And so you might say, without the terrain, why are some of the mountain roads that have low volume so risky? You add the terrain and suddenly like, oh, because that's a mountain pass. And it's dangerous. And so the ability to layer in explanatory variables along with outcomes that you're trying to monitor, this takes, what, 3 clicks? Because we didn't have to create this base map. This is just one of ours. Yeah. Esri base map's ready to go. You could create it. And this is a pretty sophisticated looking map that you can do in 30 seconds. We're going to switch over to a story map. You want to just quickly blast through and talk about the ones that we didn't talk about there?
Yep.
The great thing that Jim and his team do with every release of ArcGIS Online, they prepare, they write a really cool blog post, but they also create a live story map that has all of these live examples so that you can interact with them and use them, and they use this map journal template, which is a great way to present stuff.
Yeah, that's this one Mark talked about in Boston, and this one in Florida with the unique symbol and size style. So with every release, we try to come up with a few new styles is the term. And so when you change style in the layer, smart mapping looks at the fields you're trying to map and suggests styles that you might be interested based on did you choose a text field, a numeric field, two numeric fields, is one field a rate and one's a count, all that kind of stuff. Here's a good example of a style called let's compare A to B. Census Bureau collects an interesting data set where they ask people, well, how many of you drive alone? And how many of you carpool to work? And the results are tabulated as just counts. So there's a count of people who say they carpool, and there's a count of people who say they drive alone. And we thought, oh, that's kind of an interesting relationship because in Los Angeles, we kind of have this reputation as carpool unfriendly. And yet, when you map this out using the ratio, using the compare A to B style, compare one number to another number style, let's compare the number of people who drive alone to the number of people who carpool. And in Los Angeles, it's more, according to the legend, it's more towards the blue end of the spectrum, which is four workers who drove alone compared to the number of workers who carpooled. And out in a lot of these Midwestern counties, it's heading towards 12 workers driving alone for every one who carpools. So as bad a rap as LA gets, it turns out that county is doing a lot better than a lot of other counties when put on the same comparison. Now, we would know what the national average is unless we just did the math, right? And that's where it's kind of important to think about how you anchor your map. Is it based on a national average, a local average? A lot of organizations put out stated objectives. CDC puts out goals for healthcare concerns. You know, we'd like to get the binge drinking rate down to such and such a rate. So it's interesting to use that to anchor the map.
And by anchor, he means that midpoint. So what places are doing better and what places are doing worse than, say, a national standard that has been set. Two things I want to mention about that map. Jim, you didn't have to do any major work. All of that was calculated for you because you chose that renderer, right? Because that was the option. So that compare and the ratio, the calculation of that ratio was done for you, right?
Exactly.
You didn't have to go and calculate a new field.
It's a good point. Smart mapping is real big about, you know, if you're old school GIS and you wanted to map the ratio of A to B, what was the first step? Add field. You got to go to the database, so you have to own the database. You have to own the layer to add a field. And then you can add the field. Then you got to calculate the field. And then you got to ask yourself two questions. Are there any null values? I got to deal with that. So now I got to select all the records where one of them is not null and calculate that. Ooh, are there any divide by zero situations? Select all the records where the denominator is not zero and calculate that. Then go check all your work, make sure everything has a calculation. And by the way, what did you decide? If a number divided by null, what's the value of that? So we thought with smart mapping, it really opened the door for us. The day that the developer indicated me they could do some math on the fly, I was like, really? Really? Mark, we got to get in there.
Yep.
And this is one of the examples where you don't have to add a field. It doesn't have to be a layer you own. So when the Census Bureau publishes all those lovely counts of multiple counts of the same subject, race, count of white, count of black, count of, you can calculate your own diversity index, right, on the fly. Or if you wanted to do, in this case, I just want to compare the ratio of one thing to another to understand how these two things relate, right? That's basically it. That's a big thing in smart mapping. In our case, we show it as a default symbol, so you are aware you got a problem over here.
And you can flag them.
You
can find them. And actually, that's perhaps a great way to do it. But this idea that most people would have given up based on the workflow Jim just suggested, unless you are doing this full-time, and a lot of sort of part-time mapping folks would have said, fine, I'll make a map of one and a map of the other, and I'll just publish them side-by-side, and I'll ask people to visually compare them. The fact that you can do these calculated things on the fly without even having to set anything up, we think is really, really powerful.
It's pretty cool. This map I love. A customer a year ago at this time, on a Monday, we have put a call out. Hey, any of you have some good data that we could do a smart map demo of? And come back on Thursday, and you'll see your data up on. And somebody sent me their parcels. Lillian from Atascadero Water District sent me her parcels spreadsheet. Awesome. And also sent me the parcel boundaries, and then we joined it up, put it up there in the cloud as a layer in my organization, and we mapped the change in water use in Atascadero from 1 year to another. So this map is showing you the houses that increase their water usage by 25% are in blue, you know, from 0 to 25%, because it's a gradual thing. You know, this one maybe is at the high end, 22%, and this one, 43%. But this one that's just kind of a gray color, they only increased 2.6%. So there's a lot of detail in here, but also the volume is indicated, how many thousands of gallons. And the blue indicates increased usage, and the brown indicates decreased usage, probably because their lawns are brown. And if we look at the source data, the way it starts out life, it looks like this, right? Bunch of polygons. And if I go into change style and I ask it, hey, show me your percent change. So that's my rate. And then I say, and I'm interested in the absolute value of the increase or decrease. Now I've got a rate and a count, and I have a map. And from here, I can start to tweak the symbology. Maybe I want to see things a little bit bigger. We do have this adjust size range automatically. Now in this case, the outlier value, whatever parcel ran 2 million gallons of water, that thing is dictating everything else happening on this map. So watch what happens as I kind of reel this in.
I have to go a long way.
Yeah, I think so. We'll drag it all the way down to here.
Outlier. Yeah.
He's pretty extreme outlier. Now I'm starting to get some signal out of my map. So what you kind of see here is the power of an outlier. And once you see how strong an outlier can drive your map, you can't unsee it. When you go back to use other mapping tools, any other mapping tool, you can't help but notice, hey, I wonder what this outlier in my data set's doing to my symbology and my color ramp and everything. And that's how we kind of construct this map. We choose the color based on, you know, am I trying to tell a high to low story? Well, the percent change goes from negative to positive. I probably definitely want to tell an above and below, since in California they were trying to get everybody to reduce their usage by 25%. I see my histogram. I see, on average, people in Atascadero were doing pretty well, negative 7%, so decrease. But if I drag this up to zero, or just hand type it, now we're going to shift from the software making a reasonable suggestion to me as a human being tying this in to a real-world story. California says, everybody, please try to reduce by 25%. So let me put that 25% reduction on the map. Those guys are doing well. They're in green. And everybody in the red spectrum, you're going the wrong way. Need you to reel it in.
You can minimize exactly. You can minimize the impact of that one outlier. This was always the criticism that people who defended classification and cartography used, was they said a vanilla unclassed map stretches like the color ramp or the sizes from the lowest value to the highest. So if you have one extreme outlier, basically everywhere looks the same, and then there's one big circle. And we're saying no, just pull that slider in to discount that one huge circle, and suddenly you can tell a story about the rest of the distribution. There's so much more, though. I'm looking at how, like, you can just keep sort of asking questions and adding things like transparency. We're going to show you some examples of that. Do you want to show some how we might use transparency? Do you have something?
Transparency. Let me think real quick. I got one. All right, so the aging report. Here's a bunch of code violations going on in a city. And I initially set it up to show when was the original complaint. So like this one, the original complaint was on February 4th of 2013. And compliance was recorded a couple of months later, July 31st. So let's say that 30-day compliance is required. This person violated that. Not only did they have the original complaint, but they took more than 30 days, so they get a big symbol. One way to use transparency into this, instead of using the symbolization this way, I might instead say, let's just show color. Actually, I want to stick with size, sorry. I think it's in here. Yeah, so here's the size. So the size is based on recency. Newer things, they're like, picture it like a water, you know, or water coming down and raining on your driveway, and a big splash hits, it's a big dot, and the older dots, they've already splashed and they're going away. So maybe think about it that way. And we can use transparency to kind of double down and say, yeah, go ahead and use that, what are we using, compliance date. And I want you to show things that are new, with zero transparency, and old will go up to 80% transparent. And notice how all these old things suddenly start fading into the map.
A dark base map. I don't think they can see it as clearly on this burned out
good
projectors.
Point. When you're presenting, know your projector. Is that better? You're starting to see these things fading into the map? And it's up to you to decide, well, how much fading do I want to do? Maybe I want to take this up to 90%.
So what's great about transparency, and I would argue that transparency is the unsung hero of digital cartography. It doesn't work well in print, but it's an incredible, especially on these dark base maps, it's an incredibly subtle way to either double up the message and say the same thing like Jim just did here, or to use something else. Let me give you an example of where transparency can be very effective. We often work with data that we know has some problems with it. What if you could report the value, but then use transparency to fade the areas where you're really not confident in the value that you have? So let's say it was a reading, but the reading is 3 years old, and so you can't not map it, you have to use it, but you want to diminish its visual impact because you have less confidence in it. So think about using transparency to condition another layer in your map to say something else, whether it's currency. And the other thing that Jim didn't mention, I don't know if you got caught, he's mapping time here. He's not mapping counts or rates. He's mapping time, distance and time. And so whether you're mapping attributes in a snapshot current or how recently things occurred. And so this mixing and matching and the ability to sort of combine and say, okay, I want size plus transparency plus the fill color. That was very hard to do 2 years ago. It's really easy to do now. And you can see Jim's not actually having to hunt for it that hard. You want to go back to the PowerPoint? Yep. Just see where we want to do. So that's that demo. Okay. For those of you who are not American, this is a result of a presidential election. And the U.S. election maps always love to show things as red state, blue state, red and blue for the two different political parties.
Well, that's because everybody in that county or state voted for the one candidate,
exactly.
Right?
So what are some why does it kill me that every single newspaper and TV news in the world shows election results this way? Why is this a terrible way to understand U.S. elections or any election? You can't tell one state from another, so if you don't know the U.S., this doesn't do you much good. Right, right, there's no, exactly.
Population.
Yeah, what about population?
You can't tell anything now.
Exactly. If I didn't know the U.S., and I didn't know where people live in the U.S., I would assume this was a massive landslide for red. It wasn't. Actually, blue won this election. But because this map makes the basic assumption that square miles vote, it gave a lot of red pixels to the square miles. Square miles don't vote, people vote. So what we need is a map that shows where people are, not how big their jurisdiction is or their county. The second thing is that it doesn't tell you by how much they won, right? So where were the places that were especially close and where are the places that were landslides? And if you're in the election business, that's actually really important. It's not so bad there, but here also red and blue are just horrible side by side. Visually, they're very unstable, and it really burns our eyes up here. So please go to the next slide. So what we want to do is show you some work that Jim did to move past these ridiculously simplistic, not informative election maps. And it's not hard to do. The first thing you want to do is capture where the people are and how many people are voting. I always love to say if you didn't know, you would think that that bottom corner of this is North Dakota in the United States obviously is influencing the entire outcome of the state. It doesn't, because almost no one lives there. It's an incredibly low population.
Yeah, this is a fun one to take a look at. Let me grab the layer. It's North Dakota.
By the way, I'll pay anyone $10 if you can find me something that isn't a choropleth-based, like county-based or state-based election result map. I would love to see examples of that. We need to move beyond this. Even the New York Times does this, so they're getting a little better. They're using transparency.
So I've got this data set. And that's one of the final results. Where we often start out life is a traditional five-class choropleth map, right, where all these red voting districts are what you're looking at. They're all the same, right? 62 to 30, so the red doubled up on the blue there. Here, 257 to 106, a little more than double, and so forth. And then on the other hand, blue, 62. What's kind of interesting is if you kind of work with this data a little bit, I've got an unaliased field name, just a side note. If you don't add aliases to your users, you're being mean. You're not being very nice.
What's this one called?
This is USP _R_08, which I know you all know.
Yeah.
This is the
That's
U.S.
one of my favorite variables.
Presidential election, yeah. Republican vote, 2008. So I know you all knew that. But it would be nice if someone would take the time to alias this up and make it nice and clean, but that isn't the case. Still, though, I can work with this data. I could say, well, I'm interested in the relationship between two things, the Republican vote and the Democratic vote. And right away, the software says, oh, okay, you got two counts there, pal, so we're going to suggest a color and size map, but we don't want to limit you. You've got to compare A to B map. Or maybe you want to map the relationship between, watch the legend down here, the ratio of one vote to the other. Or I'll click this label button, and now it's the Republican vote as a percent of the sum of Republican and Democratic. Hey, that's pretty cool. Or maybe I just want to take a straight-up Republican vote as a percent of Democratic vote. They're all basically the same, right? The map really isn't changing. We're just two different expressions, three or three different expressions of these numbers. And then we thought about another style of map called, really, a vote map like this is a style of map we're terming a predominance map, where I just want to know who won. Who had the bigger total? So right here in this red voting district, Republicans won 273 votes. Over here, it was 15-5. And as Mark said, you know, the frustrating thing is this thing. Look at all these blue pixels on the map for 20 votes, right? It doesn't make sense, whereas in an urban area, you got 600, you got 700 votes, and they have far fewer blue pixels on the map. It's not fair. I'm a fourth of out of five kids. It's all about being fair, right? Okay, so let's look at this style. One click, and suddenly we're seeing votes like we wanted to see. We see Republicans. We see the counts. If I touch the map, I can break it into color up here and size. Let's jump into color. We happened to have set up a color palette that works quite nicely with this. We've got some others available. If I don't like this label because it's not very friendly, like I've been talking about, I'll just Republican and I'll go in here and type. I spell that right? And right away I can see 370 voting districts favored Republicans and 144 favored Democrats in this particular state in this particular election. And so the color is being set based on who won, and then the size is being based very simply on the count. And as always, we try to give you an opportunity to take a look at your data, pull it away from the outlier and towards some reasonable value that will cause your map to kind of light up a little bit. The average is 594, almost 600, so maybe I'd want to set this at double the average, right, just to pick a number. Okay, and now I've got a little bit of story. Notice the outlines. I always pay attention to outlines to see how well they're contributing or not contributing to the map. Now, as I recall, this kind of washes out on this map, so I'm going to... Sorry?
Where to position it?
Yeah.
How do I know where to position the slider bar? Sorry, the average is, if you mouse over the X bar, it gives you the average of this data set.
Yeah, we calculate that for you because we figured that's probably a useful piece of knowledge to think about. But as Jim said, you often override that because you have expert or domain knowledge. And an example here in elections, and Jim, you were mentioning this yesterday, and I thought that was really cool, that for campaign managers, what they're interested in are places that are between, is it 45% and 55%? So that they're what are called, you know, swing votes, sort of places where you could actually influence the outcome. If you're going, if historically you've lost that county or that precinct by 18-1, you're not going to spend any campaign dollars there because it's just, it's you know, a lost cause. Whereas what you want are those places that are 48-52 because you might actually be able to influence the outcome of the election there. And so what you can do is quickly focus in on those places that are important to me as a campaign manager and discount the places that don't, that just aren't going to be in play.
Yeah, where was that one district? It had 15 votes now. So it's more kind of in its place in terms of size. And now we can understand election dynamics are in part about getting out the vote in a city versus in rural areas. Here's Fargo, which seems to have a north-south split in terms of the voting pattern. So other expressions of this might look like, let's go back here. And, you know, maybe I might want to make just a Republican layer. If I'm going to meet with the Republican chairman for the state, I might want to show this map, and then I'm going to go across town and meet with the Democratic chairperson, and then I'm going to show both to the newspaper article, the editor. Maybe I might show them, you know, just to ease them into the conversation so it's not quite shocking if they're used to doing a red state, blue state polygonal map. Maybe I'll start them out with this one where we just kind of ease them into the conversation, and then I'll hit them with the good stuff. Right, and and finish it out and say, well, what are those white ones? Yeah, the exact tie. They happen. All right.
What I want to stress here is that Jim is working with one data set, the same information represented five different ways to tell different stories. He can fine-tune that story. He can ask specific questions. Show me everywhere between A and B. And it's not a lot of work. You notice he's not writing queries. He's not having to get into the data. We're not bringing up tables. There's nothing intimidating about this. It's if you can literally grab a slider or type a number, you can start doing filtering, exploration. And we think that this is useful for people who are new to this, but we actually think it's useful for everyone because it's just fast. Jim and I do this all the time. I mean, it's not that we couldn't do it the old way.
And obviously, everything I'm doing manually,
yeah,
because this is built on our JavaScript API, you can have confidence that you can use this to kind of inspire, create maps in your organization that get people fired up. And then when the boss says, okay, we're going to buy the AP election feed from now on, I want to feed this thing. So every election, we get this kind of map. Are you going to hand make these maps? No.
Of course
not. We're going to feed these requirements into a developer. And because this stuff, everything I'm showing you is calling an API behind the scenes, you can write rules. You can write logic into an application or code that applies these techniques or whatever techniques you want. So you can have your custom maps, your custom rendering, and it's automated, and it just cranks it out. We've implemented that kind of project many, many times over the decades.
Within Esri, folks were so pleased because we baked the rules, the logic, some of which are really, really cool research projects on how we set a lot of these parameters and do this kind of data mining to figure out the best defaults. Because we've baked it into the API, all of the other teams at Esri that use that, whether it's like the open data team or the insights team, they immediately get to take advantage of all these good smart mapping algorithms and defaults. You can do the same. So you don't have, we're showing it to you in the map viewer, but the logic of this is expressed through our API, and you feed it data, and it gives you these good answers back. And so you can build a custom app that takes advantage of the smart mapping.
When this release came out in, I think it was March, with support for predominance, this is a story map that went out. And the reason, as Mark said, we do this is, you know, it's nice to come to user conference, come to San Diego, enjoy, go to the restaurants, etc. But if this were the only place where we could educate people or clue them in about what's coming in the release, that would be kind of limited. So we always try to release a story map, a blog, and sometimes even a video just to kind of show how to use these new styles and give examples. So here's a predominant education level map where there's four columns of data in the census data set. Who has a graduate degree, a bachelor's degree, some college, or high school graduate?
Can you click on one of the columns? This is one of my favorite maps. I found something really cool in this map that I'd never seen before. So just click on any of them and you'll see. There we go. So this is the distribution. What is the predominant? Of course, you could have mapped this as four different maps. What percent of the population has some college? What percent? But being able to do a predominance map, you bring all of these together. Can you zoom over to Washington, D.C.? Zoom right into
Washington.
Oh, yeah,
this was freaky. I did not believe this.
Click on Arlington.
Sorry. Where's Arlington? Let's zoom in. Enhance. There we go.
This is a really unusual place. The most common degree in this place is a graduate degree. You got a lot of people who are in their 30s with master's degrees, really hustling on the metro every morning, trying to make something of themselves. This is very atypical, right? And so you wouldn't see that, you know, any other way. And so this sort of blending together each of these, what's the predominance, but also the degree of predominance is what's so subtle about this, right? It isn't just it's winner take all. It's how strongly predominant is it? And the fact that this is, you sort of drill in once you see the pattern and see the pop-up. I just thought this was great.
The predominance is measured as whoever's got the biggest total, what's the next biggest?
Like, how what's big is the that gap? Spread? And that determines how strong the color is.
So if it's an exact tie, you know, it's kind of a washout. There's two or more groups that are. And so this map is, these story maps are there for you to kind of go through. Here's an example using predominance. Showing a map of sales revenue versus cost. We call this the director of sales maps because every day I want to come in, and anything that lights up in pink, I'm getting on the phone. I want that managed. I want to know what happened. We don't need a lot of those costs, our sales, where our cost exceeds our revenue. We do not like those, generally speaking. So just even the simplest maps can be very powerful. Or comparisons over time. This is looking at green roads had more traffic in 2006 than in 2011, while the pink roads had more traffic in 2011. They're growing. So it's kind of shocking for some people to know that certain segments of road have less traffic than they used to. And that's why we make the map.
Oh, this one's great. Can I take this one?
Oh, please.
This map blew me away. This map shows you what is the age cohorts, which is the largest cohort in terms of number of people who make more than $200,000 a year in Manhattan. And it turns out in lower Manhattan, the biggest group are under 25 to 34-year-olds. That is, there are more people in that age bracket making more than $200,000 a year than any of the other age brackets in lower Manhattan. I would love to know what these people are doing. I would like, are they in Wall Street? Are they, I don't know. Like, what is it they're doing? It doesn't answer the question, but it points out something that I would never have thought of before. And it leads me to then want to know more and ask further questions. So just mapping this, you're like, wait, that really? That's the answer? Yeah.
How did you ramp text to correspond with the color in your
this? Yeah, in the story map builder, which one is this? This is the map journal. Yeah. We just typed the text in, we selected it, and we set its color in the story map editor. So there's a little edit tool. You can set the color.
There's a little like floating inline text editor. You can do font, size, bold, italics, basic editing. But isn't that a nice way to integrate a legend in so you can't miss it? It just scrolls as you need it.
Yeah, here's the legend. Legends are hard. Like really good legends. They're hard.
Yeah.
So what we often do is if the legend really is getting to be kind of technical, we'll usually either resort to text first because that's the easiest, or we've got access to some designers with talent, always a nice thing to have, and we ask them to build us something custom.
The other thing that I like is, as we saw with some of these examples, the key piece of information that you needed at the moment you clicked is in the pop-up. So the pop-up becomes kind of an on-demand legend, which I think is a really, really powerful way. Rather than have this giant legend always floating on the map, have it the moment you need it when you click on something. It's a nice way to organize information.
Why were legends originally needed on print maps?
Because you couldn't click on anything.
That's right. It's not web maps. It's the fact that print doesn't, you can poke at a print map all you want.
It won't tell you it's 33.7.
It's not going to respond.
Yeah.
I've tried it a lot. Here's
The best thing to search for, this is how I find it every time because I keep forgetting to bookmark, what's new in smart mapping? Google search that, and the first four or five hits will be each one of these blog posts we're talking about in these story maps, and then just drill through. We try to lead by example, so there it is, what's new in story mapping. And it'll be by date, the November release, the March release, the June release,
So with our June release here, actually it's a good segue into what's new. We have added time as a style, a couple of time styles.
Can I ask, has anyone used these? Because these were just released, 2 weeks ago, a week ago?
Yeah. 10 days.
10 days ago. How many people have used these new time-enabled renderers? Anyone?
Aha.
Okay, awesome.
You're going to love this.
Your minds are going to be blown.
Well, cool. Let me show the examples, and then we'll jump in and make a couple real quick. We're right at 11:13, so I'll be brief. This is Minneapolis. These are the streets of Minneapolis. We're mapping the date of last inspection of all the streets. So the white streets were inspected more recently than the purple streets. Some of them may be dating back as far as 2005, since an inspector last went down the street to look at the curbs, to look at the potholes, etc. So that's one way to map just the date. It's a date field. We take the date field. We spread the color across the range of values. Do you think we use standard deviation around a mean date? Yep, that's what we did, just because we don't know what your date is going to be. You don't know what your date is going to be, or maybe you do. But we wanted to start you off somewhere with confidence, and that's how we did that. Here's another map showing these are fire hydrants in Horry County, South Carolina. Bigger fire hydrants were built more recently. This is a CEO-friendly, mayor-friendly map to show, hey, boss, this is where we're working. All those little dots, they're old. Don't worry about those. It's the big dots. Look how busy we've been. And then the mayor's next question is going to be, well, that's nice to know when they were installed. I see this is a map of dates. But how old are these things? When's the last time you inspected? Because I am aware that we have a policy of inspecting fire hydrants in the last... every fire hydrant needs to be inspected once a year. So that begs the question, which of these fire hydrants have been inspected in the past 12 months? In this legend, now we've converted the date into an age. If I told you I was born January 1st, 1967, how old am I? Come on. How old am I? Yeah, right. See, you had to
you
do
had to
math.
Do math. No
you had to do
math.
Nobody wants to do math, and yep. You don't want to do math, and I don't want to do math. So
we'll show you.
We're going to show you how, with a couple of clicks, you convert your date field into an age. And in this case, now the map is showing in dark, kind of a burnt color. Anything approaching 2 years since last inspection is showing in brown. And everything that's okay, like these guys, they're all receding into the map because they've been inspected recently. They're on the map, but they're not the most important thing. We want you to see where the patterns are of inspection so that we can get the funding we need or the staff we need to go do the job.
If I can just briefly add there, I'm a big advocate of not over-filtering your data. Often if you say, well, anything that's less than, if it's been inspected in the last 12 months, I'll filter it off the map because I don't need to map it. I think that's a mistake in data visualization. What you often need to do is highlight the things that you're most interested in, the ones that haven't been inspected in 2 years, but keep them in their larger geographic context and show the distribution of all of the fire hydrants. So the ability to quickly highlight or pull out the 10% of your data set that you're interested in, but keep it in its geographic context and keep showing all of the hydrants, and using things like transparency is really effective for that.
Here are some buildings in Rotterdam, and we have the year built for all of these buildings. Some of these are dating back to the 1900s. There's some that are in the 1800s. Here's an 1893. And the red ones are built more recently, 1978, 1983. And the reason we colored this map is when we first put it in, we found interesting data. We found some buildings were built in 1941.
A lot of buildings.
In Rotterdam. And we thought, there was construction of buildings going on during the war? Oh, well, yeah, I guess so. I wonder why. And so we started looking around and found that there was a major bombing event called the Rotterdam Blitz of May 14, 1940. It destroyed many of the buildings in this particular section of the city you see on the map. And obviously, these ones rebuilt the following year. Are an outcome or a byproduct of that. So when we made this map, we thought, okay, how can we deliver some value here? Let me jump into Rotterdam buildings. And it's going to go find it. All right. And there it is. And I'm going to open this up in a new map. It's going to zoom to Rotterdam. And I've got my building outlines there in green. I'm going to touch smart mapping. Or it's called the, sorry, I've been blowing past that. This little icon here is called change style.
Change style. It's a little too hidden for my liking, but it's where you unlock a lot of this, because people are like, how do I get to all of the stuff you were just showing? It's that little icon that you only appear when you mouse over the layer. It's the layer name, and then you have all the options, and that's change style. We don't call it smart mapping in the interface, so just if anyone's confused by that.
Now, I looked up in the data set, Bojar is the field containing year built, and we all knew that, I know, but I thought I'd go ahead and change it to an actual date field. It was in there as a numeric field. And we find that in a lot of data sets where people get frustrated with date fields and some mapping software's inability to deal with date fields. We thought we'd go ahead and add a date field formally here, call it year built, and I'm going to touch the continuous timeline using color options. Right now it defaults to a new to old, but because I looked up that story about the May 14th bombing, now I can see the city a little differently. I can see a before and after this 9/10/1948. I want to drag this down to right about 1940. Actually, it's hard to drag and drop it to the exact date. So I'm going to put 5/14/1940.
That's so cool that you can type a date in there and it treats
just works.
It. Yeah.
Yeah, and then I'm going to choose my pattern. I want older to be blue and newer to be red. I'm going to add 40 years to...
And the nice thing about this is that if Jim were demoing this and someone asked a question, it takes them all of 2 seconds, you know, to bring it up and say, you're right, if 40 years doesn't make sense for you, let's use it, whatever interval you want. And so the fact that you can fine-tune these maps, you're not having to lock it in. One idea that I'm trying to pursue, and we haven't gotten there yet, is the, what do you think of the idea of exposing things like this slider control once you publish a map so that you don't have to bake in this color scheme, but you give your readers the ability to drag these sliders themselves and they can decide. So like, don't take my word for it, you can do it. So I wanted to get a sense, do you think that would be useful for us to pursue, show of hands? Or how many people think, no, I need to truly author these maps and when I publish them, this is the color, like this is the final product. Any thoughts on that? Or a lock feature, exactly.
Kind of a lock.
Yeah. Because you can do it right now. What we're assuming is that your reader is passive and they have no interest in dragging a slider or changing the colors or something like that.
Good example for that.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Okay.
And we're starting to see this as an Insights, which hopefully you saw like in the plenary and maybe some talks. Insights exposes this, so when you publish one of those little cards from Insights and you embed it in something like a blog or an app, the controls will still be there, and you can let your readers adjust these thresholds. So
that's cool.
We're just trying to figure out like how much should this be public facing, but that's a really interesting idea. You said your executives would benefit from it, not necessarily the public. Right. Yep.
I wanted to show you how to convert a time field to age real quick. These two styles deal with timelines, meaning your legend will have a date, an actual date stamp in it. And by the way, when you use these styles, it actually looks at your min and max date value, your time stamps, and it will pick the most appropriate range. Is it years, dates? So on age, when you want to convert the timestamps to age, let's do that here.
So wait, once I have a date column, it will show me that?
Yeah. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And if you want to, instead of expressing dates, you wanted to use age, you'd pick anything with the word age, age color, or age size, touch the options, and you can say from the year built to now, or maybe your study involved a previous year, you would choose that date, put it in there. It scans the data and suggests, oh, you might be interested in expressing this in terms of years or months. So watch the legend. It changes from years to months, 1,200 months. I don't know what that means. Most people don't know what that means. But the point is that it'll default. Again, the smart defaults philosophy is, hey, let's scan their data and just try to help them out a little bit. And then, again, you're now in a position to map out, you've had the average number of years, how old on average is a building in this section of Rotterdam, and can render the map from there.
One of the cool things I learned yesterday from Jim was that it automatically looks at the range of dates and chooses the appropriate temporal granularity. So if all of your observations are from one day, you're not going to see months as an option of how to represent your data, because all of your observations were in one day. So it's going to give you hours and minutes as the type of granularity that makes sense.
And we're interested in all other expressions of times, too.
Yeah.
Sometimes people do things like, in business, there are things called quarters. First quarter, second quarter, third quarter, fourth quarter, things like that. So,
why don't we wrap it up there? And we still have a little bit of time for questions. Thank you, by the way, for participating as we've been going through it. That's really great. Anything that anyone wants to know more about, see more about? Yep.
So how do you enable the smart mapping tool in RGS Online?
It's already on. Yep. And this is it's tough. people feel like smart mapping is something you have to enable, you have to buy, you have to do something extra for. It's just there, and it's been there for 2 years. We didn't change the word change style. We've always used that in the map viewer. And it's and the where it's a little different is what we were saying earlier. It's now in the API. So if you can if you look through the API documentation, you can ask it to return these smart mapping values. Like, so where should I set the handles? What is, you know, what are the parameters? How big should the circles be when they first load? All of that will be calculated for you. If you ping it, it'll get you an answer back, and then you can use it. But in terms of the actual interface in the map viewer, it's right there under change style. It's a little hidden. I wish there was a, because I'm biased, I wish there was a giant button called awesome smart mapping, but there isn't.
So. Like every product team.
Right, exactly.
We think our button
we think
be
our
biggest.
Stuff is the most important, so we think it should have a giant blue button, but it doesn't.
And it works whether you're logged in or you can be signed out.
Yeah, you can do all of this whether you don't need to be. That's what's really cool about this is you can point people to this who aren't even named users. You know, they're not part of an org. They can just get in there and start playing with data and using this. What we're also seeing are folks coming in, say, through an open data portal. They don't even know what Esri is or ArcGIS Online or anything, but they know they found a data set. Immediately now, the ArcGIS Online or open data team are using these smart mapping capabilities right there in the moment you find that data set. So you're like, okay, there's election results. You want to map them? Right here, go for it. And so they're basically what we're trying to do is influence how we approach mapping in many of our products. We started with online, but we're really trying to influence many, many teams at Esri. And in fact, they give you even less interface. You can just map stuff. So,
yeah.
Any other questions?
Well, do you guys have a wide variety of base maps available?
We do.
Are you working on adding any more base maps?
That's a great question. The question was, we have a large variety of base maps. Are you adding any more? Yes. And the short answer is the vector tile work is allowing us to do some incredible things. And there's some new, really beautiful vector tile base maps that are coming up. It took me a while to understand why vector tiles were a big deal. They're about 1/10 the size. They can be styled on the fly. The content can change to meet your needs. And it means that you can have a single source data set that gets rendered any number of ways that you want. When it's raster, everything's got to be baked in, the labels, all of it. I love the example we saw in the plenary where they changed the language between Thai and English on the exact same roadmap, and nothing had to be re-rendered. It was just like, oh, you just want to show the street names in Thai? Go for it. And so all of that is like live content that can be rendered in that last mile, as they say. My favorite new base map, do you know if paper is going to become a public base map?
I don't.
I love that one. I don't know if you've seen it. Downstairs, they can show it for you. It's like this very artistic, abstract, very cool-looking base map. It doesn't look like a reference map. It's meant to be sort of a kind of a neutral base. We have the new Streets at Night base map, which looks incredible. It's beautiful. If you've used GPS, you know, in your car, and it turns into like the night view when it becomes night, it's like that. That's what? We have the dark gray canvas, but that's really basic. And so we're adding a lot more. And the thing is, we're going to be able to innovate a lot faster now because cooking those old raster base maps took a long time. It was really manual. It was really actually creating the cache took weeks. We can style these now super fast. So it's going to the next 2 years. My prediction: base maps are going to become. We're going to see a lot of different base maps. I'm actually now worried about how do we present that as a gallery that makes sense to people. Because right now we just have that little like gallery where it's just like the 3x3. What happens when you have 50 base maps to choose from?
And just a little side note, any layer you find through search, there's often this option called Use as Base Map, where you can say, you know what, I really just want to use this as kind of my backdrop, just a simple, in this case, I'm showing a social vulnerability map for the U.S.
What's coming next?
In terms of base maps?
No, smart map.
Do you know what Jeremy's got planned?
Well, certainly time styles are just out the door.
Yep.
We had a lot more on the plate for time that, the good thing about releases is they force you to man up. Or what part of this are you going to bite off and deliver and in the right way? So we've started with these couple of renderers for time. There's more there on the plate, and we'd love to hear people's ideas. And that's why we come to conferences, to hear What do you need next? Are there maps your organization does frequently that are successful that they just take too much work manually to get done, and you don't want to have to teach 500 people in your organization to make that style of map? You want to burn that map in as a one or two click kind of thing. So that's where heat map came from. Yep. A lot of the styles that are available in smart map.
We can't say for sure, and we're not trying to be coy. It's just you know how it is. A lot of this basically becomes. You do it as R&D, and then if you see it, whether it's practical, whether it's performant, whether it's stable, and then if it does meet all those criteria, then it becomes something in the next release. So we have a lot of things working. Like one of the things that we've been working on for a while, but it's not public, are dot density maps. Because I'm a big fan of dot density maps, especially when you want to understand just general patterns of things where you have many. You're not actually trying to get exact rates, but you want to understand, like, how do pesticide use, how has it changed over the last 50 years in the United States? Mm-hmm. Dot density map would be great for that. We've got some very cool prototypes of dot density mapping and smart mapping, but it still has some weird edges to it that we can't quite solve. So I don't know when we're going to release that, but I'm really excited about it because, again, think about how few dot density maps we see out there because they're just hard to do, you know, or people don't know that they should do them. And so I'm trying to get some of those new renders. I think we've got some, I'm also interested to get into animation. I'm also working with our 3D teams in Beijing and Zurich to think about how to extend smart mapping into 3D. And this is going to be really, really interesting. How do you do three-dimensional smart mapping of, like, you know, noise pollution in an urban environment? And it's like this surface that moves. So we're starting to ramp that up. Again, I don't know when that's going to be up, but we're definitely working on this stuff. Other questions? Wonderful. We're right at 11:30. Thanks, folks. Don't forget to fill out your survey. Don't forget to come back next year. And I hope you have a great time in San Diego.
Thank y'all.